My guest today, Professor Mazen Kumpsia, teaches and does research at Bethlehem and Beerzeh Universities in occupied Palestine. He serves as chairman of the board of the Palestinian Center for Rapprochement Between People, and as a coordinator of the Popular Committee Against the Wall and Settlements in Beit Sahur. He is also author of Sharing the Land of Canaan, Human Rights in the Israeli-Palestinian Struggle, and Popular Resistance in Palestine, A History of Hope and Empowerment, and provides timely reports on the situation in occupied Palestine on kumpsia.org. This is Professor Kumpsia's fourth appearance and takes on the world going back 2007. I'm certainly pleased to welcome him again. Welcome back, Mazen Kumpsia, to Takes on the World.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me on your show.
Well, I'm glad to be able to speak with you. Let's begin. We have much to talk about, but let's begin with a story that has dominated coverage of the conflict for weeks over here, and that's a prospect of the Palestinian Authority going to the UN when it meets in New York next month and requesting recognition of the state of Palestine, an act which the Obama administration, not to mention Israel, strongly opposes. But as I gather from reading your writings and that of other Palestinian activists, there are many questions as to the wisdom of doing so. What are your objections?
Well, it seems that the Palestinian Authority under Mahmoud Abbas have taken this unilateral decision without consulting the Palestinian people or even the components of the PLO, which is supposed to represent the Palestinians. So our first concern was that the decision was made without appropriate consultation or a democratic process whereby we, the Palestinians, can decide whether it is a good move or it's not. Given that, of course, is the most important thing. Each of us may have a different opinion. I happen to have certain opinions about the notion of seeking a Palestinian statelet in part of the West Bank and Gaza and leaving the issues of the refugees for final discussion between this statelet and the State of Israel. To me, this is not a very wise decision. I have other concerns, but again, I'm just one Palestinian. It would have been wise for Mahmoud Abbas to discuss these issues with a wide range of Palestinians and get input and get a consensus about whether what is the process and how do we proceed and what would happen if scenario A happens at the United Nations, what would happen if scenario B happens, and so on.
Isn't there a history of the Palestine Authority, so to speak, Palestinian Authority, acting on its own without consulting the people of Palestine?
Yes, there seems to be a pattern here, and it's a destructive pattern, and we find it sad and depressing that there's this pattern of actions by Mahmoud Abbas and his representatives at the United Nations and elsewhere without consulting. For example, when they approved the delaying the consideration of the Goldstone report at the United Nations, Human Rights Council, and so forth, this was done without consultation and actually even in secret. The Palestinian Authority tried to get this delayed for some dubious short-term gains that they claimed that they were getting.
Well, it seems that it's almost like a dance that goes on between the Netanyahu administration and the Abbas, Abbas, particularly in Arakat and Salam Fayyad, as if they've kind of, well, they do collaborate together, obviously. And one wonders if this isn't perhaps a ploy that's going to end up actually damaging the future of the Palestinians as opposed to facilitating getting the Israeli heel off their neck.
In some ways, I mean, the Oslo process was intended to create a subcontracting system for the occupation so that the Palestinian Authority that's created becomes essentially a servant for the occupation and keep the people at bay and do some services like garbage and healthcare and take care of some educational aspects for the Palestinians, and as such relieve the occupation and allow the occupation authorities to get away scot-free and continue to profit from the occupation while not having any of the costs associated. So we many Palestinians who opposed Oslo, believe that this is certainly has been a counterproductive trend in the relationship that has developed after Oslo.
Well, one might say a couple of things happened, at least, that benefited Israel. Is one, that it relieved Israel of the economic responsibility under international law for providing for the economic welfare of people under occupation, and it also delegitimized resistance to the occupation. Instead, we ended up with a Palestinian Authority militia, which is, seems to be there to protect Israel and not the Palestinians.
Yes, indeed. This is what had happened, actually, on the practice, is that the Palestinian Authority under the Oslo process has prevented any kind of uprising or friction with the Israeli authorities and acted in what they consider good faith, of course, to based on the Oslo Accords, to reduce any kind of friction with the Israeli authorities. And, of course, friction doesn't necessarily mean violence. Nonviolent resistance, of course, requires friction, requires that the masses of people that are engaged in nonviolent resistance go to checkpoints and meet Israeli soldiers and be arrested and be beaten and so on. And they can face the consequences of nonviolent resistance that happens in all repressive regimes. And this the Palestinians were ready to do. They were not ready to go and face Palestinian police that is preventing them from reaching the Israeli checkpoints or reaching the Israeli soldiers or reaching the lands that are the Palestinian land that's behind the wall and things like that.
Well, you yourself have been very much involved in this nonviolent resistance and also have been beaten and arrested by the Israeli authorities, correct?
Yes, a few times, although I am relatively lucky in that I faced very little of that compared to many other Palestinians who have suffered a lot. As you know, there are over 6,000 now Palestinian political prisoners in Israeli jails. Some of them have been in jails for years, even without charges, under the conditions of administrative arrest, so to speak, which they can arrest you for months and years even without bringing you in front of a judge.
What do you and what's the sentiment in the West Bank when Israel makes an international campaign to free one Israeli soldier who was captured while on active duty after in a gun emplacement that was shelling Gaza several years ago, when there's not a word about from the international community about any of the Palestinian prisoners? What's the response on the West Bank to that?
Well, I mean, the people of the West Bank are between uprisings. As you know, we have had a number of uprisings since the first one in the late 19th century against the Zionist project, a project to transform Palestine from a multicultural, multi-ethnic society to a Jewish state, so to speak. And we have had a number of these uprisings. On average, about every 10 years, we have an uprising. We're now in the middle of a lull, basically, in between uprisings. And the Palestinian people on the street are less reactive than many of us hoped that they would be on many of these issues. And this is just one of those issues, which I think as time goes by, there will be more and more voices brought against these schemes, these efforts to liquidate the Palestinian cause, and unfortunately even to use Palestinians to liquidate the Palestinian cause.
Well, that seems to have been what the role of the Palestinian Authority would be. it would seem, even if, let's say, there was a little statelet or a Bantustan, it would totally be under the thumb of both the United States and Israel. And there's no question if the Palestine Authority is what it is today, it doesn't seem that it would be much more beneficial to Palestinians in the West Bank, not to mention the refugees in the refugee camps in Lebanon, Syria, and so on, who have been totally ignored by the Palestine Authority.
Indeed, you touch on the core of the Palestinian issue. The Palestinian issue is the issue of refugees, because ultimately most of us are refugees. There are 11 million Palestinians in the world. 7 million are refugees or displaced people. And this is the crux, this is the center of the Palestinian struggle, a struggle for return to our homes and land. Our struggle has never been merely to have a state in parts of Palestine, the desert parts of Palestine or in the Gaza Strip and parts of the West Bank. Our struggle has been always to return to our homes and lands. And the Oslo process and the deterioration that actually started long before Oslo in the 1970s and in 1988 when the PLO declared the state based on Resolution 242 and 338 and 181, was to say to the Israelis, look, we're willing to forfeit a lot of Palestinian rights, 80, 90% of Palestinian rights, if you are willing to come negotiate with us on the other 10, 20% of our rights. And what this showed, actually, is that the Israelis have said, oh, this is great that they're willing to forfeit all these rights. Now let's see if we can get them to forfeit other rights, and then they proceed down the line. And we have seen how that went, and actually the released Palestinian papers that were basically smuggled and released and published by a number of news outlets show that that's the nature of the negotiations that were happening. Basically, the Palestinian negotiator would come and say, we'll give you this and that to the Israelis. And the Israelis say, well, thank you very much. Now let's see what else you can give us. Come on, you can come up with more. And the Palestinians keep coming up with more and more. And this never satisfies the Israelis, who obviously have everything, and they don't feel they have to give back anything to the Palestinians.
That's an important point I'm going to get back to. My guest is Professor Mazen Kumpsia. We're speaking to him in Bethlehem. This is a point that people seem to fail to realize, that Israel is doing just fine as it is. They keep expanding settlements. The U.S. Says tut-tut, says it isn't helpful. But Israel is in no need of any agreement. And, of course, they call it peace, but it's not a question of peace. The word justice is never included. But there's kind of a myth that Israel actually seeks a peace agreement with the Palestinians, but there's no evidence of that. They keep expanding settlements and using this so-called peace process as a cover for doing so. Is that correct?
Well, not only that, but if you look at the major income for Israel as a country, as a state, what are the three largest sources of income? All three, by the way, would be threatened if there is peace. One source of income, large source of income, is from foreign aid, you know, billions of dollars that U.S. taxpayers, I am a U.S. citizen also, so I shell some of these taxes that go to the Israeli state, over $110 million every week that we send to the state of Israel. And this continues as long as Israel keeps demanding it and as long as there's no peace. If there's peace, then this would be threatened. The second big source of income for Israel is exports of military technology. That's the largest export Israel does. Israel does not export food or anything else that's of value. It exports mostly security-related things like surveillance cameras, equipment, drones and things like that, and they use the notion that Israel is in perpetual war to market these and say that these are battle-tested equipment, basically, and so they sell billions of dollars like that. And if there is peace, that will also be threatened. And the third source of income for Israel is basically us, the Palestinians. We're a captive market here in the West Bank and Gaza. Israel sells us $3 billion of Israeli products because they don't allow us to import what we need directly, and it has to all go through Israeli hands. Even the humanitarian aid that comes to the Palestinians, 40 to 45% of it ends up in Israeli pockets, and this is according to a World Bank study. So you can see that the main sources of income for Israel would be threatened if there is peace in the Middle East. And so that's why Israel has no incentive for peace. Until the boycott, divestments, and sanctions start to bite, which I hope they will soon, Israel has no incentive, negative or positive, to move towards peace.
Well, this is something that was an important point you raised, that if Israel, let's say a situation occurred where Israel and the Palestinians had some kind of arrangement, irrespective of how just it would be, and Israel and the Lebanese had an arrangement in which there was no threats or hostilities, and Israel became what they want, they say they want to be a nation among nations, then they couldn't do all these things, you say, and they would have no justification for asking for arms from the United States. And the Israel lobby here in the United States, which gets power, I believe, from this, would dry up. So one of the things that I see, and I know you've spent a lot of time here because you were teaching here in the United States, is there's almost like a vested interest that Israel supporters have in the United States, the organized supporters, in keeping the situation as it is in the status quo. Perhaps you comment on that.
That's indeed the case. I mean, there are thousands and thousands of lobbyists, paid staff of media, pundits, and others who serve Israeli interests in the United States, part of this Zionist lobby network, that would go out of business, and these people would lose their sources of income if there was peace here. They make a lot of money doing what they are doing, and in the process, of course, inducing Congress to send billions of dollars to their friends and relatives in the state of Israel. So this is why there's no incentive for them, and that's why the lobby has to be challenged. And I think this is a very critical point to make to the American public, that without challenging the Israeli lobby, the U.S. as an economy also will continue to suffer. It will continue to engage in needless wars, like the war in Iraq, which was in great part to serve the lobby's interest. And the war in Iraq cost the U.S. Taxpayers $3 trillion, and this had directly to do with this situation.
Well, it seems that the U.S. has allowed or has taken on Israel's enemies as its own. Take, for example, Lebanon, which before has never really been seen as a critical part of the U.S. global reach. I mean, when Eisenhower intervened in 1958 because they were afraid of a certain turnover, but dominating Lebanon has not been a major U.S. Policy position. But now the United States has made Hezbollah, which didn't exist until Israel invaded Lebanon in 82, its enemy as much as Israel's, and so. We kind of see this thing continuing also with the push toward a war in Iran.
Yes, indeed. The lobby is now focusing on the issue of Iran, wants the U.S. to have a conflict with Iran, and this is what they are trying to do, just like they did with Iraq. This is certainly not in the U.S. national interest and certainly doesn't serve anybody's interest. In my humble opinion, not even the Israeli public interest that benefits from these things.
Now, as we saw
in Iraq, you know, even the oil companies that were supposed to be the beneficiaries, Iraq oil contracts are now going to Chinese and Russian companies and not to American companies. So it was not about oil. It was because the lobby thought it was good for Israel. It actually didn't end up being good for Israel. The war in Iraq actually strengthened Hezbollah, strengthened Hamas, and strengthened Iran.
Exactly. I want to shift for a moment because you mentioned the Israeli public. In recent weeks, we've seen several hundred thousand Israelis protesting deteriorating economic conditions. And with exception, I believe, of maybe one tent or two in these kind of tent cities they set up, which dealt with the issue of what's called Tent 48. Do you see any significance in the fact that ordinary Israelis who support Israeli policies down the line toward Palestinians are now complaining to their government about the differences, the gap between rich and poor, and how do people on the West Bank see that, and do you think as this can lead to something positive in terms of the relationship between the two people and resolving the conflict?
Well, I think it's a step in the right direction for Israeli society, the average Israelis, to begin to challenge the state, the concept of the Israeli state. Now, we have to realize that Israel is not an ordinary state. It's not like any other state that I know of. Israel is basically an army with a state. Most Israeli political leaders are ex-generals, and the Israeli army and the military establishment is what runs the state. And the best indication of this is actually what happened to these protesters last week, when there was an attack on Israeli soldiers in buses near Eilat, or Umm al-Rashrash, as we call it in Arabic. Immediately, these protesters had to fold their tents and suspend their things, and the Israeli state went back to its militaristic notion of supporting the state, kill Palestinians, attack Gaza. Two-year-old kids were killed in Gaza in a period of about 30 hours, and so on. And this re-rallied the Israeli public. It was a kind of a convenient thing, and that's why some Palestinians and others, even Israelis, think that this may have been an Israeli action, because a false flag operation, because Netanyahu was under pressure, and this came as a gift for him. But whether it was a flag operation or not, the point of what happened afterwards suggests that these protests have a long, long go to challenge the mentality of a fortress Israel, an Israel that's a militarized Israel run by people like Ehud Barak, who's a general in the Israeli army, and others who are basically the architects of war and conflict and who profit from war and conflict. So housing is the last thing on the agenda of people whose agenda is war and conflict.
Well, I'm glad you brought up the situation that the attack and the counterattack that took place in Israeli called the Eilat, their resort across from Egypt. There evidently were a number of warnings given to Israel, this state that is overly conscious and more conscious than any other of security. And yet these warnings were apparently ignored, and this attack by persons unknown came at a very convenient time, not only to stifle and shut down the tent protests because of the loss of 8 Israeli lives, but also at the time just before the announcement, before the UN meeting, which gets more sympathy, of course, for Israel and shows that it cannot trust the outside world. This brings up the case of the changes in Egypt, and what implications do you think this has, in which the Egyptian government, which seems to be like Mubarak light in terms of dealing with its people, but has taken appears to be taking a different policy towards Israel. What effect do you think this will have on the overall conflict?
I think I see some positive signs in front of us, but we have a lot of challenges. The Egyptian revolution, Tunisian revolution, and others now happening in the Arab world, if truly they bring democratic structures in these countries, clearly this is good for the Palestinian struggle, because the average man on the street in Egypt or Tunisia or elsewhere in Syria and Jordan is supportive of the Palestinian cause and is supportive of human rights, is supportive of democracy. The reason we had problems like in Egypt and Gaza and the siege on Gaza was because there were dictators like Hosni Mubarak in Egypt or the royal families in Jordan and other parts of the Arab world and Tunisia, who are more than happy to serve Israeli interests as articulated by the American Secretary of State, basically, because the American Secretary of State now basically is a spokesman for the Israeli authorities, or spokeswoman, as the case for the Israeli authorities. So this is, when somebody like Mubarak falls, of course, it's a transition period. But the signs are good, because, you know, under Mubarak, there would not have been a demand for an apology from Israel for the killing of three Egyptian policemen at the borders. Which Israel did intentionally and with malice, basically. And the Egyptian authorities are saying now, in indirect ways at least, but they are saying, basically, we're not going to be subcontractors for Israel in the Middle East. We cannot continue to act like that. We have to watch our own interests. And this is good. I think this is something that's very positive. And if they follow up on it, and if there's indeed democracy in Egypt and elections, this will even be more more problematical for Israeli apartheid and racist policies.
My guest is Professor Mazen Kumpsia. It's now 12 minutes before the hour, and I've opened the phones for any callers. The number here, of course, is 895-2448. If you have any questions or comments for Professor Kumpsia. Here we have a first caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello, Jeff.
Hello.
Thank you so much for this show. For those of us who try to have this conversation in our community, could your guest please give us some information that the idea that we send $110 million a week to Israel is something worth documenting and being able to talk about. Could he please just address that a little bit? Who exactly is that funding coming from, and a source that we could refer to when we're having conversations in our communities? Thanks so much.
Did you get the question?
Thank you. Thank you. If you Google just United States assistance to Israel, or United States aid to Israel, maybe the article in the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs had a very good article. You can add that to the Google search, and you can get the data and the sources of information about these things. But basically, Israel is the largest recipient of U.S. foreign aid. This is documented by the U.S. Government itself on its own websites, on the state government website. And if you take this aid and divide it by the Israeli public, you will see that it's tremendous. We actually give more to Israel per person than the federal government gives to some states per person when you divide it as such. And we give to Israel more than what we give to sub-Saharan Africa and Latin America combined. And this is together is more than a third of the world population, whereas Israel is like 0.2% of the world population or 0.1% of the world population. So you can see the disparity and the illogic of giving a very highly advanced country, which has Israel has nuclear weapons, chemical weapons, biological weapons, they have fourth or fifth strongest army in the world, and we give them more money than what we give to anybody else anywhere in the world. In fact, one-third of our foreign aid goes to the state of Israel. This is amazing, and it should be challenged by writing to our congressmen, by writing to the media, by writing to newspapers, and by writing to our neighbors, by informing people and explaining to them why this is harmful to U.S. image abroad and harmful to U.S. national interests.
I should add specifically under Bush, but approved by Obama, Israel received a guarantee of over 10 years, $30 billion in free weapons. That's out of the taxpayers' pockets. And those will include, starting as soon as they're available, the latest jet fighters, F-35, which will be allowed to put certain Israeli parts in those fighters. Now, the Israelis, some other countries have contributed to the funding for the F-35, but Israel, which hasn't contributed, is going to get the first crack at them. But this is something that is never debatable. In the latest debate in Congress over the debt crisis and cutting aid, both parties declared that aid to Israel is off the table, which means aid to schools, Social Security, anything else will be on the table, but aid to Israel is off the table. And this is something that most Americans are not aware of. If they were more aware of, they would be. But this, the economics, it's interesting. Israel did not suffer economically during the economic crisis. And there, although there is a huge gap between the rich and poor inside Israel, and the poorest, of course, are Palestinian, 20% Israeli Israeli citizens who are Palestinian Arabs who remained from 1948. But
I do want to say something about Congress. Congress in its recess, 81 congressmen came to visit Israel, and their trip was paid for by the Israeli lobby. And they came, they chose, every one of those 81 congressmen chose to come to Israel instead of spending their break, their August break, with their own constituents, listening to the economic problems of their own constituents. They decided to come and declare loyalty to the State of Israel and to the lobby that supports them in their elections. This is unprecedented. And as we know, when Netanyahu, a very right-wing and extremist prime minister of Israel, went to Congress, he got a standing ovation, more times standing ovations than any president who spoke in front of Congress before him, any U.S. president I'm talking about. This shows you the power of the Israeli lobby over our Congress and how this Congress has become not a servant of the American public, but a servant of Israeli interest in the U.S. And that is why this congressman needs to be shamed, and they need to be publicly, all 81 of them who came here, they need to be publicly shamed and by writing letters to them and to the media and telling about them and what they chose to do over their summer break.
I mentioned that on my program and earlier before I called you. One of the congressmen went over there and bragged about it on his website, a Republican named Meehan from Pennsylvania. And after getting 154 stinging attacks for doing so and neglecting his responsibilities here, he took all the comments off his website. I think Americans are starting to wake up. We do have another call here. I'm going to go to... Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, Jeff. I don't know what happened there. The line went dead. I was just wondering if he knows where the funding for that program for basically its youth indoctrination, an Israeli, a State of Israel form of history, and doesn't really have a balanced presentation to these young people, and if he might know where the funding for that comes from, and if it's maybe not through the Israeli lobby here, and maybe actually
which
taxpayers here in this country are paying
about?
For that.
Which program is he talking about?
What funding for what program?
It's a program for youth who can improve their Jewish heritage.
Oh, Birthright.
To go to Israel.
Oh, yeah.
And,
the Birthright program.
And it's basically a state version of the history. I don't know what happened to the line there. Just cut out. Thank you very much for the program, Jeff.
You're welcome.
Thank you. The Birthright program is a program to take young Jewish kids who are generally do not really pay attention to what's happening in Israel or in Palestine or anything like that, and bring them here on a brainwashing tour to make them good Zionists, basically, make them support the State of Israel, support the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians, and paint the Arabs and the Muslims as these vicious monsters who cannot be lived with, they have to be ethnically cleansed. This is what the program is about, and it is funded by wealthy Zionists from some families who are well-known for their support of Zionism historically. And these families, which also make part of their wealth by supporting Zionism, it's a cycle, basically. They take part of what they gain from supporting Zionism, and they spend it to support Zionism. And so that's how it works. And the good thing is, very interesting thing is happening now, is some of these young Jewish kids are saying, well, if they pay our tickets to go to visit Israel and get this brainwashing trip, we might as well extend it by another 2 weeks and go to Palestine. So they would get their tickets through Birthright program and spend the 2 weeks with Birthright, but then spend an additional 2 weeks with us here in Palestine. And this is a program that was started by a group called Birthright Unplugged, and people could Google it, because it does not require a lot of money, basically, to extend your stay for 2 weeks. And we Palestinians are more than happy to host people in our own houses if they want to come and see what's going on. So you know, they are welcome to come and see. And I know some Jewish kids who came on the Birthright program, and instead of being brainwashed to support Zionism, they did get all the lectures of the Zionist projects, but then came and saw reality for themselves, the wall, the refugee camps, the ghettos that are left for us, the water situation, the colonial settlements on our land, the olives that are destroyed, things like that. And they decided then to become very supportive of human rights.
And on that point, Mazen, we've come to the end of a very interesting, enlightening hour. And I want to thank you so much for being our guest today on Takes on the World. And I know our listeners will take away a great deal of information from what you said and encouragement. So thanks so much for being our guest again, and take care.
Okay, thank you very much. Take care. Bye.
Be well.